Today is August 26, 2017. This is a Grand Canyon Historical Society oral interview. And today we are interviewing Joe Richards, R-I-C-H-A-R-D-S, at the home of Tom Martin, and that's me. And Joe, thank you very much for being willing to participate in this.
Thank you.
What year were you born?
In 1936, yeah. March 17th, 1936.
Where were you born?
Lubbock, Texas.
What were your parents doing there?
They were farmers and affected by the Depression, like so many people. Texas was a dust bowl. My mom tells me 5 days before I was born, she was pulling a 100-pound cotton sack down the road picking cotton. And so that's kind of the background, that we starved out like so many people, so many families, Okies and Arkies, and moved to a little town in Glenwood, New Mexico. And I was about 3 years old, between 3 and 4 years old, when we moved there. And my dad worked for the CCCs, and my mother ran a little pie shop there. Then in 1942, when the war broke out, they moved west and were originally heading for all the jobs in California, but the jobs didn't pan out. It was sort of like the grapes of wrath. And they stopped originally in Sligman and then back to Belmont when the Navajo Army Depot opened up as a munitions depot during the war. My dad worked there for the next 33 or 34 years as a munitions foreman, as a security guard. He was one of the first mounted guards in the depot to patrol the out perimeter of the fence by horseback. He was one of three or four guys that were hired to do that, and then later on they became mechanized and used trucks and pickups and stuff like that. But that's kind of the background of our life there. I grew up in the community of Belmont and went to Flagstaff schools, Emerson School, Flagstaff High School, and then got both of my degrees from Northern Arizona University. So I'm an almost native.
Almost, I'll say. What did you get your degrees in?
In police administration, both of them, both bachelor's and master's.
What drew you to that as a education, to get a degree in that?
There was an interesting event in my life. The little community of Belmont was a mixture of different kinds of peoples, different backgrounds, different ethnic groups. And one of our neighbors that lived there was named Henry Singleton. And a group of bad guys from south of here, down by Mormon Lake in that area.
So how do you spell Singleton?
S-I-N-G-E-L-T-O-N.
No, thank you. Sorry, so some bad folks there.
They were four of the Blevins brothers. B-L-E-V-I-N-S. I don't recall all their names, but there were four of them. So one night they got drunk and were going to go out to Belmont and beat up on Henry Singleton. And they knocked, banged on his door and revved their engines and called him out. And he stepped to the door and he says, "Get out of here and leave me alone. You're going to get hurt. Get out of here." They refused to. And one of them was making an aggressive move. The other one was going to go around and rattle the back door. He stepped out the door with his shotgun and bang, 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 shot three of them and wounded the fourth. And so the buckshot hit our little tar paper shack there where my parents lived and woke us all up. That was my first introduction to really violence and the consequences of violence and blood. I was 10 years old. That was on May 10th, 1946, when that homicide occurred. Before morning, the sheriff came out, J. Perry Francis. He was the sheriff of Coconino County, P-E-R-R-Y-F-R-A-N-C-I-S, Francis. And he had another deputy with him, and this guy was about 6'3", 6'4", tall like yourself, and had a uniform. And here's a little kid, you know, named Joe Richards, looking up at that. And it was sort of a commanding appearance of this guy, and it made an impression on me.
Wow.
Now, between law enforcement and cowboys in the West, I was thrilled with that. Hmm. So I, when I got out of high school, I went to work for the county, for the county sheriff's office in the first of 1960. I had worked 3 years previously for the U.S. Post Office as a mail carrier, mail deliverer.
While you were going to high school?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And started out working 3 days in the field and 3 days in the jail division. And there were 14 deputies working for Coconino County in that time, for the second largest county in the United States. And there was a lot of long hours. It was exciting. You know, you get to do things that you always dreamed about.
Can you back up for a minute? Because I'm kind of curious about Belmont.
Okay,
In the 40s and 50s, and when we drive past Belmont, I can see the depot to the south of the interstate.
Yes.
To the north is some newer looking tract housing. What was Belmont like in the 40s? Where were you all living, and what was it like there?
This was prior to the big overpass being built.
On the interstate?
Belmont. Hmm. It was old Highway 66. There was no interstate at the time. U.S. Highway 66, the main drag where people were going back and forth to California to
Route
find 66. All these jobs.
Sure.
And our family, my dad built a small little house for us, and it was only about 75 yards to the entrance to the Navajo Army Depot, where
wow.
big trucks and stuff like that were bringing in munitions and supplies. It had probably 2,500 employees when it was up and blooming. It employed a lot of Native Americans. They had a Hopi Indian camp and a Navajo Indian camp. We got to have interaction with a lot of those two cultures, and it was a great learning experience. My mother ran the post office at Belmont, and there was a little general store there ran by a man by the name of Delbert Thompson. He had a sawmill, and so that's some of the background. This little community of Belmont probably had 20 to 25 families, very small, and most all of them were workers in the depot in various jobs. And so that's kind of where I grew up. Atchison, Topeka and Railroad was about 100 yards away, and if you'll see old Belmont right now, there's a huge black tower that rises up about 150 feet. That was a pump for the steam engines and the locomotives to stop and get water on their way to California.
Okay.
And a little side note, it was interesting, when the troop trains would come through there, my mom and some of her neighbor friends would make sandwiches and coffee and go over and give the boys sandwiches and coffee. So it was a love gift.
Nice. Yeah.
For a lot of young men that would never come back.
That's right. That's right.
So
yeah,
that was a kind, loving act, and it still touches me as I tell about it.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, the people got along well there and were very compatible with each other.
So it sounds like, I mean, Belmont was its own town, removed very much from Flagstaff.
Yes, it was. It would be 11, 12 miles west. And it was...
Which was a day's walk.
Just west of that was a little community called Brannigan Park, where it had another little community, group of people. And then just west, about 15 miles, was Parks, where you go up Spring Valley, and there was another small, a bigger community there.
Okay.
The people lived. Most all of these people were either employed for the munitions or worked in Flagstaff, or some of them worked for the railroad. There was a section house right there by our place where the switchmaster, the guy who was in charge of the railroad's safety and stuff like that, lived with his family. So it was a very eclectic little community. A lot of interesting people there. They had ammunition boxes that were surplus, and they were all empty and pile them there. They made delightful playgrounds for young boys who wanted to play cops and robbers, building houses and forts and stuff out of those boxes. A lot to keep boys interested and involved.
So when you went to grade school, was that there in Belmont, or did you
go
in
Flagstaff?
And
rode the bus for 12 years back and forth.
All right.
Yeah.
How long did it take to get the bus out there?
Probably 45 minutes. We'd catch the bus about 6:15 or 6:30 in the morning in order to get to school.
And come into town.
And a lot of snow. It was a deep freeze kind of community in the winter months. There's pictures in 1948 of our house sticking up out of the snow, and my mom would You can see her standing outside, level with the snow.
Wow.
And it looks like a bunch of little stovepipes, people all burned wood. And so it was a hardship winter, but it was exciting at the same time.
Yeah.
We loved it.
Yeah. Nice. Okay, so then work for the post office during high school. Was that the Belmont post office that your mom was in?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It was a little single. In fact, it was in our home. They had set up the little mailboxes for her, and the mail would come off, and they would drop it off of the train as it came by, roll it off, and she would go bring the sacks down. Or sometimes trucks coming from Flagstaff would haul mail out and drop it off there. So she and all the residents that lived at Belmont, Navajo Army Depot, up at the depot itself, and these other little communities would go there to pick up their mail. She almost, it was a first name, you know, she knew almost everybody in the whole region.
I bet she did.
Yeah, it was great.
And I'm assuming that the mail volume would have been fairly substantial for the depot.
It probably was.
I mean, more I so mean, I, than I remember, parks yeah, or, yeah, or yeah. any other community that didn't have basically a large factory there. Where people lived. It was a military base.
The base itself was a huge attraction to employment for the whole region. I think Flagstaff probably had 6,500, maybe 7,000 people in 1942. And this huge influx of people that wanted viable government-paying jobs. There was a little railroad that went to around all the igloos. There was a lot of construction of warehouse and ammunition igloos and storage facilities. There was a hospital there. In fact, I had my tonsils taken out there. And it was a government-ran hospital. And my mother worked up there for a period of time in the kitchen, helping cook meals for the patients and things. So it was exciting.
Hmm. Okay, and so after school, then, would you walk the mail rounds? How did you work that? Or did you have just help sort mail?
I didn't work. No, when I meant I worked when I left Belmont. I went to high school.
Yes.
And then I got married right out of high school.
Okay, wait a minute. Back up a second. So did you come into Flagstaff? Did you guys move into Flag? Or you said you left Belmont and went to high school?
I left home when I was 16.
Thank you.
And I moved into Flagstaff. And here's another great story. I met Platt Klein and Barbara Klein. They were wonderful friends. They were like another mother and father to me. I was next to a brother of their own son, Robert Klein. And we were buddies all through high school, had a double bunk bed. And we had, all the funs that young teenagers do. Upon graduation of the high school, I got married. And I'm still married to the same sweet lady. We just celebrated our 63rd wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
I laughingly tell everybody, we were married young. I was 9 and she was 8. brings a big goofball out of everybody. But it's been great. We have 4 lovely daughters.
How did you meet your wife?
In high school.
Okay.
I was sitting there in a typing
What grade?
Class. Oh, I was probably a junior.
Hmm.
And so we fell in love.
Hmm.
She had moved here from California. And her folks had a restaurant down in Sedona.
Oh, wow.
And so we fell in love, and I would hitchhike from Belmont, go get on old 66, and hitchhike down to Sedona to get to see her. So that was our courting arrangement.
Oh, wow.
Great, great relationship.
Very fun.
And it's worked out really well.
So you moved into Flagstaff. Did you stay then with the Klines? And that's C-L-I-N-E?
Yes. For a period of time, during the time of high school.
Okay.
And then I got married soon after high school, so I did various jobs. Construction, working in service stations, doing carpentry work and things like that. Kind of a jack of all trades. And then, I think it was in 1957 or 58, I went to work for the U.S. Post Office. And I had 2 routes. One was a walking route for 12 miles, this region where you're living. And the other one was a 16-mile route. And then I also drove a parcel post truck for them.
Okay.
So I did that for 3.5 years. And in my off time, I really wanted to be a deputy. And so I began to hang around the sheriff's office. I began to make myself available and known. I joined the sheriff's reserves. And there was a group of probably 8 or 10 guys that would help out for parades and different events and things like that. And so it gave me first-hand knowledge of what goes on in a county sheriff's office. And Cecil Richardson was the sheriff who hired me. And that was in 1960. And I worked for him for like 11 years. And then I was a state highway patrolman for about a year or so. I was a criminal investigator for the county attorney's office for a little bit more than a year. And then in 1972, I ran for sheriff. And I was elected and then ran 8 four-year terms, 32 years, in the county sheriff's office. This was a great life, great experience. And I tell everybody, after 44 years in law enforcement, I was almost off probation.
<That's>
It was a great life.
So let's bring Grand Canyon into this equation.
Okay.
You live in Flagstaff. Well, you live in Belmont, growing up in Belmont. Mm-hmm. When was the first time you saw the Grand Canyon or heard that there was a big canyon up to the north of you?
Well, I think it was an attraction to our family, and I think we drove up there once or twice where we got to just walk around the rim and look and see, realize just what a tremendous piece of geology that was.
This would have been when you were a young boy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, probably I was in teens.
Okay.
And so it was a great experience getting to see it. So I was aware of the Grand Canyon and the beauty of it and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I never did hike down in it, never did go down in it.
Okay.
And then after working for the sheriff's office, we'd do search and rescue. There were plane crashes, there were drownings, there were lost people, there were suicides, all kinds of things that attracted people to be involved in at that canyon. And that meant that law enforcement had to respond to it. So we worked closely with the National Park Service, and we had our own search and rescue team, and we did a lot of the canyons, some body recoveries. People would, you know, take a nosedive off, either accidental or on purpose. And there were drownings, different types of drownings. There was an interesting homicide of a young couple in 1977, I believe. Perhaps I can recall the name of it here in a minute. And both of them were found by the Powell Memorial on the West End is where their bodies were found. He was a young dentist in the military, I think in the Navy. And they stopped there, I guess, on their way back, or they were heading for the coast, and their bodies were both found there, side by side, by the Powell Memorial. Apparently a robbery and murder. To my knowledge, that murder has been unsolved. Hmm. There's been a lot of trails that led up to loose ends and bad ends and finding guys in prison that you interviewed and stuff like that. But as far as I know, that is still one of the unsolved mysteries of Grand Canyon.
Tell me more of your relationship with the canyon then. So you mentioned plane accident. The first thing I thought of was 1956 when TWA v. United.
I was aware of that because Clark Cole was the undersheriff. He was stationed over in Williams. He worked for Perry Francis. And he went up there to the Grand Canyon. And some guys went down into the canyon, Chuar Butte, and I forget what the other one was, where they crashed into these two
Temple
big planes.
Peak. Sure.
And so it was exciting to hear about it. Some of the photographs that came back out showed where they strewn the mountains and the bodies all over the country up there. So it was a major national, maybe even international, catastrophic event, because many of the people that were on these planes probably were nationals. And that was an exciting event. That was 1956.
That's right.
I can't remember the date.
Yeah,
but anyway, these two planes crashed. That was one of the first ones that came to my attention.
Hmm. Okay.
There were several others. There were two planes that crashed together in the inner canyon, almost straight out from the viewpoints, down where the lodges are, where Hopi Point, down that direction. And it seemed like that there was a regular little plane, small craft. There were two smaller crafts. I think one of them had several passengers in it. Anyway, there was a crash there, and so then we had to go down to the canyon. And they would we hooked a ride with the National Park Service or with the National Guard, because we Coconino County did not have, I don't think still has any air machines. So we'd go down there and do body recovery, photographs, identifying next of kin, preparing it for the mortuary and stuff like that, so the bodies could then be transferred back to be identified by relatives once they were notified. And it was hot and, you know, rocky and all kinds of stuff. And it gives you really, those kinds of things are really firsthand knowledge of the terrain, of the difficulty of it, of the hazards of it. And it was just one of those kinds of things that, now there were other kinds of, yeah, there was another significant thing. In 1974, a senator from Nevada called and advised that his son was overdue for a couple of weeks. I think his name was Dennis DeBall, D-E-B-O-L, I believe. I'm not completely positive. My mind might be a little rusty on that spelling. But anyway, his name was Dennis. Tall young man, 6'4", well built. And he had left and hiked down in the canyon around shortly after Christmas, around New Year's, and had hiked down through there, never to be heard of again. Now, they didn't know, I don't think that there was a registry of him going down there, but it originated from his folks and other relatives calling and saying, yeah, have you heard anything? So from there, the identification started, you know, narrowing. Has anybody seen anybody? Yeah, well, we found somebody here that saw a hiker matching that description. He was alone, so forth. So he was found near the Tanner Trail, off the old Tanner Trail that you know runs down on the south rim. And he had his pack still with him. He just jettisoned his pack and fell forward. Didn't have any, I think he died of exposure because his body had laid there for a number of days before we found him. And it was one of the, during that period of time, there was another great natural event taking place, an inversion in which the clouds, I've got pictures of this, the clouds rolled into the canyon. And it was almost like a great mystery. When we would go, they would take us by National Guard helicopter, our crew of guys that would go down, and we puncture this stuff and go down into it. And then when you get down there, it's eerie because you have all the shaded clouds. Wow. It's not dark, but it's, you know, it's subdued light.
Right.
And so we would take our team of guys going here and there looking for tracks and stuff like that. That ultimately is what led to the finding of the young man's body. Hmm. But the beauty of that inversion, you've probably seen pictures of it from up one of the lookout points, how the clouds were just floating by. Well, I was down there for a number of days with the guys. They'd let us down and you know, give us a box lunch and pack, and it would pick us up in the evening. And we had a couple of the guys had communication, so you could stay in touch with the guys. It was an interesting time. Hmm. Learned a lot about the canyon and stuff.
Who did you work with in those days? Who was your Park Service liaison?
Oh, my. I'd have to look it up. I'm sorry. Right offhand, it doesn't spark.
You know who comes to mind would be Gary Brangie's father for a while, because I think he graduated in 1974, and I think his dad was head of law enforcement for four years or so that they were there. Yeah.
I'm sure he knew about this and maybe have led up a team of park rangers that were there. We worked with them.
Well, this,
but,
yeah.
But that name does not...
Tom,
it doesn't ring a bell with me.
No worries.
There was another guy for search and rescue early on during that period. Dick North? North?
Well, there was Jim Northup, but he was much later. He was in the 90s. And I'm thinking, of course, if we go back too far, we go back into the 50s, but... You know, that's Lynn Coffin back in that time. I'm trying to remember who would have been a law enforcement. Oh, Vonderlippe would have been in there in the late 60s, early 70s. George Vonderlippe, he was the head of the river unit, law enforcement ranger. I'm trying to remember who he...
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared for that.
No, yeah,
I'd have to wing it.
No worries.
I mean, you know, if it comes back or if I'm told, this guy we met. Because you meet a lot of guys. Dinner. I mean, you go out in the morning, you shake hands, you get their names and stuff like that, you hand your equipment out,
right,
and you go do your work.
Right.
And even you come back, and you may not see that guy again on that same search.
Mm. How did it work with law enforcement? Because I think of the small gateway community of Tucson, and there was no deputy stationed there.
No, there wasn't.
There was, for a while, a deputy stationed, Bud Dunnigan, and I'm
yeah,
sure
Bud,
you
Bud's
know,
a neat guy.
Yeah, and Bud, of course, was stationed.
He's a mule guy, you know.
He's a mule guy, yeah. Yeah. And that's, so Bud, Dorothy's gone through this, what we're doing here, to learn, because I wanted to learn about the clinic. So Bud was actually stationed there in the park.
Okay.
As county sheriff's deputy.
Okay.
He had a vehicle.
He had been out of Williams. That's where he was from.
Okay. And he had a radio in the car, and so they could, there was some communication potential. Then after Bud left, and there would be a time in there in the 60s and 70s, I really don't know what would have happened, but I was kind of thinking, how would, you know, if there was a bar fight in Tucson, I'm assuming that the park would send their rangers out.
Well, they would many times.
And you guys would drive. It would take you an hour and a half
or
more.
Yeah, yeah. And it'd be the Williams officer that would get up there. That would be the first guy to interact and find out what went on.
Okay.
Because you're right. I cannot remember offhand when we stationed the first officer up there. Maybe it was, but we had one on the north rim, the little community of Fredonia.
Okay.
Cecil Cram was up there for years and years. C-R-A-M, he was a local guy that worked in the community for a long time. I think his wife taught school. Just a delightful man.
And he would have to drive then from Fredonia up to the North Rim if there was an issue
there. He handled the problems on the North Rim.
Wow.
And so, you know, you got a 200-plus mile jog to get around there. It was like the old days.
Well, it really was.
It was.
Huh.
I'm trying to think of another. And if you want to jump forward, you asked me the other time that we visited about my experience with the Grand Canyon River.
Sure.
The first opportunity I had, I've been fortunate to be there a number of times, go down the river, a lot of them with the Park Service on recon, a lot of them for search and rescue operations, missing bodies and a plane crash and looking for that, things like that. This one, I knew Jerry Sanderson. He had a river shop out of Page.
How did you know Jerry, and how did you first meet him?
Page is one of the substations for Coconino County. There's Fredonia, Page, Williams, Sedona, Grand Canyon, Blue Ridge, Forest Lake Estates, and then later Tuba City. There was either eight or maybe nine substations for the county.
Okay.
And it was a really interesting experience because I could travel 3,000 miles a month in Coconino County and never leave it just by going around and checking with the rural communities and stuff like that.
Wow. Just checking on the substations.
Uh-huh. And people that were there, burglaries or thefts or, you know, deaths, either accidental or suicides or other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you meet Jerry?
I met him when in Page. He was an interesting guy, and we just happened to get acquainted up there. And he said, hey, if you want to ever come up, would you like to take a ride? I said, oh, it was a dream come true. So later on, several months down the road, I had that opportunity, and we boarded up there at the head of the outfit above Rainbow Bridge.
At Lee's Ferry?
At Lee's Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And went down riding on Jerry's out, and it was a great adventure for me. I try to be an artist. I have sketched and painted most of my life, and so I'm an amateur painter. But I got my first set of oil paints from my mother. She was a kind of a backdoor painter herself, and I kind of took that up and began to sketch. In fact, I was in class when I met my wife in high school. I was sketching instead of doing my typing class. And she relates that story, you know. Anyway, back to this. I was just enthralled with the canyon. All the events I'd heard about, you know, I'd read the books and all the stuff. You go, oh, Vasey's Paradise and all this stuff.
What year was this? What did you do?
1974.
1974,
yeah,
okay.
It was the summer of 1974.
So you had already been exposed to the canyon on your various searches and types of events.
Mm-hmm. But I had never had a river trip.
Exactly. What do you remember about that trip?
It was fun. I was a swamper. You know, I set up the toilets and fixed the fires and did the gopher work. That's what you get to do. And I loved it. I just, you know, it was an exciting opportunity. And I remember that. I heard stories of how cold that water is, you know, 44 degrees. And I So in the evening, we're going to go down, we're going to take a little bath in the river. And I thought, man, oh man, it's like jumping in a deep freeze. It was exciting. But we went on through the canyon pretty well, uneventful. Stop and cook and all the good things. We hiked up to the cliffs. I forget the name of it, up in the upper canyon.
Nankoweap.
Where
the
Nankoweap
is. Mm-hmm. You look downstream.
Yeah. And I got some pictures from there, and I thought, oh,
I'd love to see those photos.
I think I might have some, but I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, that's you're talking ancient history, Mike.
Yeah.
And so I was just thoroughly enthralled. And we got down to where the Little Colorado flows into it. And you see this blue-green water flowing into this because it had rained a time or two and some of it was muddy there. So it was interesting. Hmm. Got to do a little side hiking. Never did go up that far. But later on, I got to go and do, when we were on other searches, I got to hike up that canyon to where the Sipapu is.
Nice.
The Sipapu is a travertine built-up structure, probably 40 or 50 feet around. And it is, it's very sacred to the Hopi people. In fact, there are prayer feathers on willow branches all the way around it where they would come and have ceremonies and say their prayers. Beautiful place, quiet, and there's blue-green water bubbling up out of there. And then on down where they used to mine salt, where they would bring salt up the Salt Trail and up the Blue Springs Trail and stuff. I thought I'd seen some steep trails. You look at that Blue Springs Trail and the Salt Trail. One wrong step and you can travel a long distance before you hit anything but rock. Anyway, it was an exciting time. And going on down the river and getting to see some of the other sites, I don't recall all of them, but we had this anticipation building up because, we've had wrecks in lava falls and all like that, so the pucker factor is alive and well. I'm building up some anxiety as we get down there. And so we had two boats, and the first one went on through, and it was kind of a ride, and you see them going down like that. And we thought, they did it, we can do it. And so we go down in this thing, and unexpected, completely unexpected. And we dive in and come up on this big, huge wave. And we come up, and the raft shudders just like this. And then it begins to fold over, boom, like this. There's a picture in this magazine that shows the beer sack, where you carry beer out of a gunny sack, and it's making a big, beautiful arc, shoom, over the river. And wow. There under the lower part of it is the background, the boat. And the last guy on the lower left-hand side has blue trunks on. I'm coming off, and that's me. and me and the poop house got unloaded at the same time. The portable toilet. And I see this thing. It was sort of like the Poseidon Adventure, where things were just floating around all over you. And I thought, I could see the sign. Sheriff drowns in Grand Canyon. And so it was an exciting thing. But, eventually I came up, poof, and cut my... And fortunately, I was near the raft. I had come up beside, and I got a hold of the bow line, pulled myself up on top of the raft. And at the other end, there was a guy struggling at the other end. I crawled down and got him. He was a dentist from some place. I don't remember the guy's name. But anyway, I pulled him up, and when the raft was going on down, and it kind of went into a little back eddy as we got over. We managed to grab a hold of some and stabilize it and get a hold of a tree and pull it over gradually. Later, when everybody got back together, we righted the thing. It was like, tipping over a huge mountain. But we got the boat righted up. And nobody really got hurt. One guy, when he came up by a ledge, he was so excited. He says there was a rattlesnake poised there going... like that. And he thought, oh my goodness. So apparently he went down a little bit further.
To get to shore. Oh my gosh. So the first boat made it okay. So the first boat would have been down below you.
And they're the ones that did the picture. The one guy was on there was a foreign photographer. I think he's from Germany.
Okay.
But he did these photos. In fact, the written story in this Bund magazine is in German. And we had it translated. We got a copy of it. And I've still got that. But it tells the story. Shows the pictures where you go under the bridge up at Marble Canyon and a lot of things at Elf's Chasm and stuff like that, bathing in them, and then where you're laying in the mud and everybody gets up and does the booger thing to everybody else.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Those were just really special memories.
Fun.
Of our adventure there. So it kind of locked in my mind.
Did you lose anything off the boat? I mean, how much besides the pooper, I guess?
Oh, I lost a guitar.
Oh, no.
And a pair of boots.
Uh-oh.
But that was, I had other stuff. Uh-huh. You're living in your skivvies. You're living in shorts.
Do you remember who was driving the boats? Was Jerry?
Jed.
Was Jerry on that trip? Was he?
Yes, he was there.
Okay, so Jerry would have been driving one boat.
Uh-huh. And Wolfman. Wolfman was there. I forget his name, but... And then... Goodness. Jed was the boatman. In fact, there's a picture of him in this magazine that shows he's got an old umbrella that's got about three veins sticking out, and he's got it over his head like this. I don't remember his last name, but he was an interesting guy. He was a boatman also.
So you got the boat back over, everybody got back together, nobody was hurt.
Yeah, nobody was really hurt. I mean, a few scrapes and batches. And I was a scared guy, I can tell you that.
I bet. So great. down to Diamond Creek then, and took the boats all apart, put them on big trucks, and got
all
in the back
out.
Of the truck.
It was great. Hot. You know, I remember that part. It was a hot day.
Yeah.
But it was a great adventure.
Did you do anything like that again on the river? Was that
No, we never flipped.
No. I mean, did you go on more river trips after
that? Yeah. Not well, I went on another one in 93, Bill Diamond. And I got to take my wife on that one, Diamond River Expeditions. And I think that was in 93, maybe 95, something like that. It was a later trip before Bill passed away. And I was fortunate that my wife and I got to go together. And it was during the fall, and so we wore a lot of yellow raincoats because it was rainy and stuff like that. But it was a great adventure.
Nice.
Now, I went several times with the Park Service. Going down looking for plane crashes, one of them guy that had plummeted into the river, and that little plane apparently submerged and wasn't found for a long time.
Hmm.
I forget the circumstances, but I remember that there was a plane crash. That was one of the things. And then they did another expeditionary thing where they would go and get to walk up through some of these side canyons. That was one of those that I got to go up to the Sipapu. The other one was up at some of these other side canyons where there's a lot of petroglyphs and old dwellings and stuff like that. First-hand chance to see these beautiful sights.
Nice.
That, you know, how many people get to see that?
Mm.
So it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Good.
Excellent. What else do you remember about park management, superintendents, working with the park as your career went on and it sounds like maybe as your career progressed, you'd more and more in the politics and day-to-day bureaucracy.
In the management of it.
Management.
Uh-huh. For the most part, there was a really good cooperation between the Park Service and the County Sheriff's Office. We had a deputy at Grand Canyon that was there for years. Steve Luckeson. I don't know if that name ever hits you. Luckeson. I think he still works up above Bullfrog. He may have retired by now. He worked for the Park Service up there. Anyway, he was our resident deputy there at the Grand Canyon for a number of years. His wife's name was Cheryl. She worked at the Canyon Squire. No children. But he was the shotgun for our group up there.
Okay.
Now, if you're fortunate enough to have some of the names of the early superintendents, I'll probably say yes or no. I regret not being prepared.
No worries. No. In the 1970s, it would have been Dick Marks, Superintendent Marks.
Mm-hmm. And who was, I remember him, who was the deputy superintendent, Bruce Shaw. Bruce Shaw was there, and I was friends with Bruce. Ah, goodness. Yeah. Any later ones that you could?
Well, Boyd Everson, I think, was in there. I'd have to now start looking up. There were a number of superintendents in the 1980s. Marks was in the 80s. Of course, then Superintendent Arnberger came in.
Yeah.
In the 90s. Superintendent Alston and Martin, who am I missing? Yeah, Rob Arnberger, Joe Alston. These are some of the people from the 90s and 2000s, but I'm just trying to think of who. It must have been Dick Marks in the 1980s.
Yeah, I think it was.
Hmm.
But anyway, I knew many of those guys, and we had a very cordial relationship because usually they would do us the courtesy. They usually would be the first ones who get the information from a surge or from some sort of catastrophic event, that we could kind of mobilize and get up there. And they were, for the most part, the initial response, particularly when it becomes either cars driving off the edge intentionally or jumpers going off the edge, committing suicide. And they had a crack team. I had never done any technical climbing before. So we got to see the movies the night before and do all the things, get all our equipment together. I went up there and I think, I don't want to ask my guys anything that I won't do myself. So I went up there and we got to the edge, you know. It's like this. You think, boy, I didn't realize it was that far down. But we did the basic rappelling. We did the basic of knots, belays and stuff. And it was my first introduction to technical rock climbing. Got a real crash course in it, a real appreciation. It just whetted my appetite. And so over the years, I'd have an opportunity to go do that, whether it's in Walnut Canyon or some other places. And I never got to be expert at it, but at least I got where I was. I did the last 3 years of my career here. I was on the technical rescue team for helicopters.
Wow.
And I had never done that before. So learning all the stuff and being able to suit up and put a sling on you and you snap down, the helicopter will be over here running some about 100 feet away, and then you snap their line into here and he lifts you up so you can place a guy either on the edge of a cliff or strategically trying to make a body recovery. And from there you determine, you know, can you get a litter down? Can you get the guy? Is there somebody that can stabilize him? And how is he out of it, or is he dead or whatever? But that kind of experience of learning how to use those things, and I never got over the thrill of when they put you on the end of the line and they're doing maneuvers and you're on the end of this, and the helicopter's swinging like this in a hard turn and you're out on the end of this pendulum. You think, whoa, you pull some G-forces.
Oh, my gosh.
That is really a pucker factor. It's just great.
I bet.
It's great. I bet. So I got to do that often. Someone real rescues a lot of it on training. It gave me a lot more confidence. The first time I rappelled out of a helicopter, there was another pucker factor. I thought, just me and this rope? Yep, just me and the rope. And we did a lot of training down at Oak Creek and some of it, you know, some of the other canyons around Flagstaff. And it was a great experience because he had access to the DPS helicopter at that time. And we got to be close friends with those guys, very competent guys, much like the park guys that did the flying up there.
I bet. So not only was it Grand Canyon National Park that you shared jurisdictional work with, but I would assume it was also Mojave County.
We would work closely. There was a real close understanding among the sheriffs. If you need help, you call us. And if we need it, we're going to call you. And to the degree that help was there, to the degree that they could spare it, they would give it. No cost or anything. Just
there.
Gratis. It was a really good tournament. And you got a chance to get acquainted with the other sheriffs of the other counties, learn what some of their problems were. So there was a real, in my years as sheriff, and there were 32 years, I got a chance to do a lot of really close friendships and bonding, learn about these men, their backgrounds, and appreciate, you know, and learn what makes them tick. Nice. And so it was good.
Nice. Yeah. Because I think about Grand Canyon, which encompasses two counties in the state here, Mojave and Coconino.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a geographical place that shares many different jurisdictional Native American issues.
A lot of search and rescue on the North Rim, because our officer up there, Cecil Cram, would learn about it, or Jason Bundy was the other officer in later years that was there, and he just got through retiring this last year. Jason Bundy, B-U-N-D-Y, good guy. He just finished his 30 years. So we would do search and rescue, bring the guys up and start looking. We many times have kids that would wander off from their parents looking at the sites and doing different things and just, you know, get lost. And so getting lost in that country is pretty hazardous, you know, especially a kid frightened, and deep canyons and cliffs and stuff like that. So there were a number of those, and I have some memories of some of those that were, you know, heartbreaking, because you find them and you have to explain to the family.
Yeah. Yeah, and that even just recently, a year or two ago, there was a group of hikers, and the one person went one way and they never saw him again. I mean, the vegetation's very heavy, very thick.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to get separated and then hard to get home.
The peaks have been a major attraction for that. On the first, when I was first elected sheriff, I think it was over the New Year's holiday, there was a major snowstorm that had come into the peaks. I mean, this thing hit. Well, the people that went up there, I think there were five people. One of them was Clint Smith's son. Clint Smith was the Maricopa County manager. And it was his son, a very large, very heavy young man, and some of his friends, and a girl went up the peaks with him. And so they hiked up, not really prepared for any kind of weather, not having any technical equipment stuff. And the storm hit, and they got chilled, they got, you know, confused, they got in big trouble. And the girl apparently chose not to get in a sleeping bag with one of the guys, and she froze to death. Clint Smith's son froze most all of his fingers off, a couple of his toes, but several of his fingers were frozen, lost them to frostbite. And it was a real tragic situation.
That was 1974?
Uh-huh. January 1, I think it was in 1974. Mm-hmm. There were five people up there, and she was the only fatality, but all the others were suffered from. And we learned a lot about mountain rescue at that thing. In another search, there were some young men that, and I forget where they were from, they're Fernandez brothers. And we had another storm come in, and we learned about it after the fact. My family was up there hiking. We don't know. They were supposed to be back two nights ago. We haven't heard from them. So we're getting a late time of notification. And we finally located them in a couple of days. And they were all naked. They had pulled off all their clothes and sprung out and died completely of exposure, probably 75 yards apart from each other.
For the decades now that you were sheriff, what changes did you see? I mean, you mentioned...
Honey, are you going to come home? Hello? 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 Who is this? What do you need, sir? Crap. I'd like to choke somebody. I get these things all over, and I've tried to, you know, take me off your list. Oh, yeah. Well, baloney, you still get it. I think I'm fair game for all the sucker.
Well, you and the rest of us, I try to look and see, have I put this phone number in the phone?
And I didn't recognize it. Once in a while, I get it. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I was just curious over you mentioned when you first settled with your family in Belmont, the population of Flagstaff was 6,000 or 7,000.
Yeah, it was very small.
Now it's 60,000 or 70,000.
Yes, it is. University is a major source of growth here. I think we got like 28,000 students. Every place you drive, you get new chicken houses built up seven stories to house the students. So somebody's making some money from it, I guess.
So these changes that you've seen to Flagstaff as it builds up and now deals with... infrastructural issues, road issues, the roads aren't big enough, as you mentioned. Just you've got to drive across town to pick up your wife and then come back to this side of town. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, well, I'm going to need an hour to do that. I used to need 10, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. What changes like this did you see within the Sheriff's Department, related to either Grand Canyon or Mojave County, or, you know, up to Page, or you know, what other things have happened that you've seen?
There were more and more calls for service in the outlying areas, hence... For the first time, for instance, south of Flagstaff, south of Mormon Lake, there's a little community called Blue Ridge. And developers had gotten public property or private property and developed a little housing unit. They had got some water and a few wells and stuff like that. But mostly the people, they had electricity, they had to have propane. A lot of them had wood stoves. And so it becomes a burglar's paradise because it's so remote. People leave there, some of them use it for summer homes, and they become target of opportunity. And other people go up and they get lost, or the kids go out in the woods, and so you get search and rescue going there. And then you got some stupid people that do things like firearms shooting around houses and stuff like that. In a county this size, there's always, we have no shortage of nuts. I think they come here. Traffic, though, is one of the main things, I think, that has affected Flagstaff. Just the day-to-day life. Traffic volume, traffic control, traffic accidents. And that when you put this many people in the same volume of area, you create problems with each other. There's unhappiness. There's space requirements. For the most part, the old folks that lived here, old like me, appreciated their independence. They came from self-sustaining people, and they appreciated that privacy, and they didn't like the crowding. Hence, though, they'd move out to the other side, Doney Park, out through these rural areas, and many of them still continue that process. But they work in Flagstaff. They work either for the university, for W.L. Gore, a lot of the other institutions and things around here. So the increase in people that find viable jobs here in this region have played a big role. And most of it good, because it brings a greater economy and wealth into the community. The builders have been able to build more and more homes. And so subdivisions are not lacking in this area. But I find some of the traffic and just some of the restrictions that come about with that.
You know, it was interesting. I was thinking about our next-door neighbor here, Jim Sanders, who you'd mentioned taught you English in high school. Jim and the Northern Arizona Hiking Club that Harvey Butcher was a member of wanted to go to Rainbow Bridge, and they borrowed a state bed truck from the county here and drove all the way out to Rainbow Bridge, and they made their hike, and they drove all the way back. I mean, it was a time when
it
was a community, and you kind of knew people.
Yeah.
What people of the community do you remember? You mentioned Platt Klein, Jim Sanders, Harvey. Did you know Harvey? Did you talk
Not
to
personally.
Harvey?
I knew of him.
Okay.
And I saw him a time or two. I had occasion, you know. And he was a wonderful guy and a wonderful hiker, but I never did really get acquainted with him.
Hmm.
I mean, okay. He carried this legend about himself, a loner. You know, just a guy who was the one who wrote The Thousand Mile Summer. He was a noted hiker, and he wrote a book about it. Anyway, he was another one of those kind of independent guys that would go back and against all knowledge. Well, again, at that time, you just do it. You just do it, I think. And he was a noted hiker. But I don't think the Park Service put any restrictions on him, saying, you know, you can't go down there, you can't go down there, you ought not to do that.
They did for crossing the river.
Did they?
With his air mattress. There was much kerfuffle. And then, of course, Boyd Moore drowned on a river crossing with Harvey. And that was in the 50s, though. But it's interesting because, you were sort of mentioning why people came to Flagstaff, resilient people that wanted some space, that wanted some room. And now today, those resilient people have left.
Well, they have. I find a great respect for people like Platt Klein, like people like the Babbitts, who have invested when they first came here from Cincinnati in business, in dry goods, in groceries, clothing, pharmacies, I think they had pharmacies, and lumber, and automobile things, and of course the ranching. And they did very well. They've started in the outlying area of Indian trading posts and interacting in a very positive way with the native people. And so that brought in a real cross-cultural thing that exists to this day. I got to say, I've really been blessed with my knowledge and my interaction with the native people here, primarily Navajos, because that is the dominant tribe, but Hopis as well. Platt and Barbara Klein introduced me when I lived with them as almost like a son. They had many Hopi friends, and they would come in from Flagstaff or into Flagstaff from Moenkopi and across the Second Mason, some of these other places of communities for the Hopi people. And they would bring the Kleins baskets and little pots and, you know, love gifts, just nice. Really. And the Kleins treasured those. And so I picked up on some of that. In later years as a young officer, prior to even being a sheriff, I would go out to Moncopie, and I met Daisy Nelson. Daisy was a friend of the Kleins, and she lived there. And she said, come on in, Joe. I'm fixing to make peaky bread. And I thought, oh, this is great. So there's a little small shed out and back, probably 6 feet by 8 feet, like an overgrown doghouse, with a little door you go in. And there she sits down. There was a little small place for stones and a fire that they would build, and they would feed it with the little, like kindling out of cedar wood. And it would have such a pleasant aroma, the smoke and the thing, and feed that fire, and it would just pop and crackle. And on the stone where they make this peaky is a local native stone that is like a flagstone. And over the period of time, it looks like Teflon. And they would take watermelon seeds and put on that. And the watermelon seeds would fry, and they would smooth it, and it would season. The oil from the watermelon seeds would season that. And then they'd take the peaky bread, which is blue corn, and it would be ground real fine, and mix that into a batter, real thin, thinner than a pancake batter. And then take their hands and put it in their cup of their hand, and it hit this hot stone, and go, and then they would roll it like this, and it would make a almost like a cinnamon roll thing, but in this case made out of real thin fry bread, blue corn fry bread. And I would sit there, and she would tell me the stories of their origins, the origin of the people, wow, how they would come from the Sipapu. And it would touch my heart, it still does. But to be invited into that culture and share with that people, try to pick up one or two words, but to learn of the rich things, their kachinas and stuff like that, that as a Christian, I don't hold to that. But I have grown to have a real appreciation and a real respect for what makes those people who they are.
Oh yeah,
they have probably more than any other tribe been able to protect their beliefs and their religion and their ceremonies far greater than a lot of the other tribes have. And I would, you know, learn to say, you know, a little greeting like you say to a Navajo woman, Yat Eshama, which is a greeting. And I did that to a Hopi woman recently, and I said, Yat Eshama. She says, I'm Hopi. I says, oops, Lola Mai Kwachi. She says, that's better.
Yeah.
So I said, that's about the extent of my Hopi.
Well, it's got to be hard for all the Native American groups to hang on to their tradition.
It is. The pressing of the culture, working, education.
Absolutely.
All those kinds
all
of
things.
And then economy.
Yeah.
Most of the people out there are dirt poor.
Absolutely.
They're just
absolutely
dirt poor. And my heart goes out to them.
Yeah.
I think the Navajo grandmothers are the source of holds this tribe together. They're the glue, they're the epoxy,
yes,
that holds a lot of the families together.
That's right.
The other youngsters, they go out and get drunk and do things, have kids, and grandma winds up taking care of the kids,
right,
supporting them,
right,
and feeding them.
Right.
So they are a rich diamond in that culture, in that tradition.
You've brought some material here today. What did you bring us?
This is from Upatki. It's an interesting little story. One morning, we get a call early from the National Park Service guy at Upatki National Monument, about 30 miles north of Flagstaff, saying, we got a guy up on our flagpole. He got about a 35-foot flagpole, and he's tied a small plastic boat up on this thing and winched himself up there during the night. Underneath that, he has got a facsimile of a body hanging underneath it with the name of George, the president, George Bush. And he's got a flag hanging down for him. He's quite a character. They've had trouble with him before. He's been a problem employee, and so this guy has winched himself up on top, and J.D. Protiva was his name, Protiva, and he had been a troubled guy. Park Service had problems with him for taking his mules and going up on the backside of the peaks up the old waterworks road and being up there, and so they've had a lot of interchange with him. Anyway, he did this to make a big statement. And so I went up there, and I had known of the guy, you know. And they had a couple of mattresses underneath this flagpole, you know, like if he does a nosedive on there, we're going to try to catch him. Well, somebody had, from another construction site, one of these scissor lifts. And so they got And I said, let me try to get up there and see. If you come, I'm going to jump. I'm going to jump, Joe. I said, well, JT, you hang on. I want to get up there and talk to you. So he managed to hang on, and I got up there, and they jacked this thing up. Now, the wind up there is blowing about 30, 35 miles. And so we're both going, he's on the flagpole, and I'm on this thing like this. And I thought, Lord, I sure hope he doesn't jump. Anyway, I talked to him at length and finally talked to him. And I said, JD, you don't need to hurt yourself. You don't need to do this. Well, the Park Service, they're not going to give me my retirement, which was an issue that he was had a fit over. And so I finally talked to him and got the guy down. But it was touch and go there for a little bit because he had this rope around his neck. You can see it here, and it was tied. And he tied it around his neck. And so, in other words, if he does jump, he's going to hang himself up on top of this flagpole. So it was kind of a fun thing. I mean, it wasn't fun, really fun. It was exciting. But anyway, to be able to get him down like this, and we kind of became a little bit more friends after that. Huh. And he hung around for a period of time. I don't know that he still lives up here. He was an interesting guy. He found himself a large magnet, and so that he didn't have to pay his electric bill, he put a magnet on his meter.
And that stopped the little wheel.
It stopped the little wheel from turning. Anyway, like I say, he was a character. There's some of the things that on this that talked about him. That was that was an exciting thing. That was one of the little nuggets.
I mean, I think of the Protovas, a local family here, and Frank Protova, who perished in a plane crash with Tom Moody. It was back in the 1990s, 2000s-ish. And they ran in, maybe iced up, just flying out of Flagstaff, trying to get down to the valley, and then went down south of town. But I've
seen a lot of plane crashes like that.
Mm. The altitude density. I mean, here we are pretty high, and I think pilots are figuring that the air is so thin, they load up with fuel, and then they run out of runway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They can't get up. And I digress.
We've seen enough. One of the kinds of things that I have grown to appreciate, and all the time, I appreciate the history of our people here, of our culture, the ranchers. My grandfather worked for John Babbitt. He would cut fence posts and corral posts and stuff like that, and haul them in his old truck up and build fence for Babbitts. So I became acquainted with some of the Babbitts, and of course I worked for my grandpa. He would go down to, worked out by Ashfork, cutting posts, and I had a little personal thing. You take a double-bitted axe. We didn't have chainsaws. You cut everything with an axe, and so you bury your axe in the side of a tree, and you take your file, if the axe is buried like this, and you file into it like this to sharpen it, and then you turn it over and file the other side. That makes it really razor sharp. So I'm feeling, toom! And I thought, uh-oh. So anyway, I cut this around here. This one was a later accident, but I cut this around here. And man, the old blood, and it hurt like the dickens. I cut it clear to the bone. So I took my bandana and wrapped it. My grandpa comes up. He says, what do you got? I said, well, I hurt myself. Well, let me see it. I said, well, okay. So I unwrap. Oh, he says, that's just a learning scratch. Let's put some coil oil on it and you get back to work. dry sense of humor, an old Texas cowboy. But I learned a lot about hard work. I learned about honor. I learned about trust.
Mm.
And I learned a lot about sweating from that man. Anyway, he was friends with John Babbitt.
Mm.
In later years, there's a book called The CO Bar, which is their brand for the Babbitt Ranches. And he authored that book with some of the great stories and the sights around Babbitt's ranches.
Nice.
And he gave me a copy of it. It says, to Joe Richards, the best sheriff Coconino County has ever had. It just touched me again.
Yeah.
Just a great guy. Anyway, here's some of the kinds of things. This is a picture that was built by a guy that Platt Klein knew.
So this is a picture of a wonderful cabin. It's a two-story cabin. It's got a porch in the front.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an upstairs window. It's got a corrugated tin roof, a couple different fireplaces.
And it's up on the snowball road, but on Hart Prairie Road.
And who built this? Do you know?
I just had a blank. Maybe I can think of it here. Anyway, he built this place. He would come into town. When he was about 90 years old, he and Platt were friends. And George Hochdoffer, H-O-C-H, D-E-R-F-F-E-R. Hochdörfer, I think it is.
H-O-C-H-D-E-F-F-E-R.
Uh-huh.
One F or two?
Two Fs, I believe. Hochdörfer.
Okay. George.
It's H-O-C-H-D-E-F-F-E-R, I believe. Anyway, he was one of the early German families. The Mickelbaughs were another one, and I was privileged to know Pete Mickelbaugh, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-B-A-C-H, Mickelbaugh. And there was another old German with the name of Friedland. You've probably heard of Friedland Prairie being named after them. And so these families, they moved to this region, and he homesteaded this land. And he would go back and forth from Flagstaff. Many of them would plant potatoes. Grandpa Mickelbaugh, when he would come into town, he'd bring his wagon full of potatoes. And I remember as a boy, going to Emerson School, he would go right down in front of it, down Aspen Avenue. And all the kids could get to run up and jump up on the wagon. Grandpa Mickelbaugh was there with these mules taking it out. He grew those potatoes up on the mountain near this place here.
Okay.
So anyway, George Hochdörfer is friends with Platt Klein. He walks into Platt's office one day, and Platt says, "George, how you been doing?" "Oh, I'm doing all right." He says, "What's the cane for?" He says, "My doctor told me I should carry a cane." A little story like that. It was just a nugget, just a real nugget.
So I'm going to ask you to write on the back of these photographs names of the people, what you remember about them. And I'll do it today, but the first thing I do when I see a picture like this is I look on the back.
Okay.
Where, what year, who, how. And I
I can get some of that.
Yeah.
This guy has some interesting things over here at the Pioneers Historical Society. One of these photographs similar to that is a painting. And I think I did one of the sketching of that thing that's over here in the Pioneers Historical Society.
It's a gorgeous cabin.
It is.
Is it still standing?
Yes. And it has been bought by the people that own the light company.
Okay.
And they're living up there right now, commuting back and forth. And they're having another home adjacent on the property built for themselves.
Nice.
Delightful people. Here's another old homestead that was up there that has a lot of beautiful
So this
things.
Is great. This actually looks like possibly a barn building. High-pitched roof, split-rail fencing here, grass, aspen trees, looks like pines in the background.
This one here is up on the side of the peaks, and that was hand-built by a German guy. Let me see if I can think of his name. Certain spring. I should have written some of this stuff down, but I didn't.
But you're gonna.
Yeah, I'm going to. Anyway, you can see they have tongue and groove.
Which is a really nice...
This cabin has been taken down and restored, and it's over here in the city park right now.
Okay.
It's completely redone. This had a basement in it. It now doesn't. But it's essentially the same thing.
Wow.
As a boy, we would go up there, and Platt Klein's son and I would camp out by this cabin.
Nice.
And cook out, and occasionally miss school. I'm not sure. I think that was up on the north side of the peaks. It's an old well.
Yeah. So
where they would roll the buckets down.
This is so. There's a picture of a well. There's a building in the back, which almost looks adobe.
It does.
And
now that would be up near. I think near some of the Espiel, Auza. They were sheep people that came here, and still, in the old days, they would bring sheep up, herd them up here. And then in the winter, they would herd them back down the valley.
Right.
But they would be, in the summer months, this would be some of their grazing lands.
I mean, in theory, the Schnebley Hill Road was used to get the sheep from the Verde up to the highlands in the summer, and then right back down.
Yeah,
again.
That old road, you can still see it. It still exists. I don't know if I have stories of this one. That's on the east side of Mount Eldon, where they blasted through that. It's an old tunnel that goes to the inner basin of the peaks.
Right, this is a...
The Waterworks Road.
The Water Trail Road.
And I jogged that a time or two with a police officer. It's about 17 miles up there. Every step you take, you're getting less air to breathe.
It's right uphill. Steep climb.
By Lockett
Steve
Meadows.
Klein. These are great black and white photos. They're 10 by 12s. They're really nice pictures. Picture of the peaks here.
Here's the one that shows the old... This is an interesting site because I've done a painting of this one right up here. It's interesting to me because it represents the site of a 1940-something B-24 bomber, and they all perished in a snowstorm. My dad was one of the guards, Naval Army Depot. He went with the rescue crew up there to retrieve the bodies and bring it down.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did he talk about that? Did
no,
talk about
not much. No, he just said, yeah. You know.
We did that.
We just did that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is up near that cabin. Thick, beautiful stands of
gorgeous
aspens.
Nice and black and white pictures.
They are one of my favorite trees to paint.
Hmm.
These are petroglyphs up on the rocks of deer being hung on a lodgepole.
Nice.
And they're still viable and they're still up there.
This is in the basalt,
springs.
In the basalt rocks up on the sides of the peaks
mm-hmm.
there. Nice.
I wish I could connect right now with this guy's name. I'll have to add to that later.
Hmm.
But anyway, the source of this cabin's water, there were a series of three or four springs, and he dug out a little pond and made it there. There's still a little concrete cabin about the size of this table, and the spring's still up. It's a little concrete basin, but it provided water for the cabin.
It's a spring house.
Yeah. Interesting.
Nice. Well, water was a big deal, and to have water here at the peaks, that's what got the railroad up here. I mean, everybody was looking for water was key. So those are some great pictures.
This is on the north side of the peaks.
When did you take these pictures?
Oh, 1960-ish.
Okay.
Long time ago.
So these cabins were clearly from the 1800s, is my guess. Looking, this is a picture of a cabin from the 1860s that most of the shingles are off, major parts of the roof.
I went up there with Cecil Richardson, the former sheriff. He was quite a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that the story of this is that a bear came after it got into the cabin, and he went up here in his attic, and the bear just absolutely ravaged the lower part of the cabin and apparently left and went away. But I guess the guy he wasn't hurt or anything like that.
My gosh.
But it was a kind of an interesting little story.
Yeah. Very nice.
I wish that I had brought some more of those things that I could use for talking points, but I didn't.
No worries.
Have I left anything that you want to talk about? Before?
You know, I typically wrap these interviews up with a question.
Okay.
What would you want to say to someone who's going to listen to this tape 50 years from now?
I have been blessed to be a part of the history, the rich history of this community, of its people, the ranchers, the forest people, the native people, and being exposed to those kinds of things, whether it's the cattlemen or whether the Navajos. I have been privileged to go to Navajo weddings and funerals and house blessings and things like that. And it has added a great richness to my life and my experiences. I went to school here, was brought up here, got married here, and raised our children here. I have four lovely daughters and a whole passel of grandkids. And so the Lord has been good to me in my career. In 44 years in law enforcement, I never had to shoot anybody, and I never got shot. I come close a time or two. I really did, sitting across the table from a guy with a gun just like we're sitting right here. But the Lord watched after me, and I've had a really great life, and a safe life, and good health. I have, until the past couple of years, I've been a long-distance runner, and I would just love it, but that was my life, in all kinds of weather and snow and ice and everything. And so I miss that. I really do. My wife used to say, "Boy, you're grouchy. Why don't you go out and run?" So those are some of the little things that I think I'm proud of. Of my life experiences, the things that I have been privileged to be a part of, whether it was tragedy or a lot of fun things. That's it.
Cool. Sheriff Joe Richards, thank you very much for participating in the Grand Canyon Historical Society Oral History Interview. Today is the 26th of August, 2017. My name is Tom Martin. This has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for having me. Well, I hope that provides a little